Welcome to Bluefish Radio. I'm your host, Lawrence Gunther. Bluefish Radio is a show about the future of fish and fishing in Canada, so you will have the skills you need to become a steward of your favorite fishing hole. Hey folks, Lawrence Gunther here. You know, I thought it was time that I should get my River Keeper volunteer training. So when I heard that the St. Lawrence River Institute for Environmental Science was offering a course in partnership with the St. Lawrence River Keeper, I jumped at the chance and went down there, and they allowed me to record the training session. So I hope you enjoyed it and learn as much as I did from this session.
Thank you so much for coming tonight. Welcome, Sego, for our friends from Akwesasne. We're really thrilled. My name is Karen Cooper. Actually, I work with the St. Lawrence River Institute of Environmental Sciences, and I also work with the Remedial Action Plan for the St. Lawrence River. So I wear a couple of hats. But I'm really, really pleased tonight to acknowledge our river partners. It's not just one organization, not just two organizations, but many organizations that are working on and along the St. Lawrence River. And everybody talks about the Great Lakes, but I like to say it's a great river, and it's an amazing river, and it's our river, and we share it. Between three nations right here. So, and we never forget that actually that this, where we are right now, what was inhabited first by our First Nations, and then we had settlement here from other nations, and here we are today. So I'm really thrilled out of all of that to acknowledge that every day I get to work with all three nations. And some friends that I've met along the way and that have been working along the St. Lawrence River for about four decades or so, tirelessly as advocates for the St. Lawrence River, is an organization called Save the River from Clayton, New York. They go up and down the river throughout North America advocating for the St. Lawrence River and its health. And actually, they've been working around this part of the world for a long time. So tonight, we're really thrilled that we have with us Save the River. They're also known as the Upper St. Lawrence River Keepers. So they have an AKA that you may want to check out. They also sport some very cool gear. When Lee stands up, you'll be able to see the really neat uniform they get to wear. The Canadian Border Services were really pleased that they actually let them through. That's a whole other story. If you want to hear it, I'm sure Lee will tell you about it later. So tonight, we're going to talk about riverkeeper volunteer training. What does it mean to be a riverkeeper? How can we support the health of the river? How can we all do that? So I'm really pleased tonight that we have Kate Brahini from Save the River and Lee Wilbanks, the official riverkeeper of the Upper St. Lawrence. And they're here tonight to present to us about being a riverkeeper, what that means, and what we can do to make a difference ourselves along the St. Lawrence River. So I just want to welcome them to Cornwall and thank them for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Karen. It's a real pleasure to be here. And yeah, crossing the border over was a lovely 30-minute delay, but we made it in plenty of time, so that was really nice. Folks in the back, can you hear me okay? Okay, great. Thank you so much. And please raise your hand if I step away from the mic, and if you just acknowledge raising a hand, I'll step back closer to the mic. I tend to wander when I talk. Just a few little housekeeping before we get started. I do want to thank the St. Lawrence River Institute for inviting us to be a part of the Nature on Tap series. This is a real pleasure. And also I want to thank Schnitzels for hosting the event, and I'm looking forward to a beverage afterwards. but I really want to thank everybody for joining us today. I want to acknowledge and thank you for your time for coming here, and I hope that by the end we will have shared a little bit more information about our wonderful river that you can then take out and use on your own time. So thank you so much. Bathrooms, restrooms are just directly across the hall, so please, that's where they are. Time frame, we tend to do the presentation in about an hour and 15 minutes, but again, for discussion purposes, please, if you have a question, I invite you to ask it along the way if you like, or if you'd like to save your questions toward the end, we will certainly have time for that at the end. Each one of you has a Riverkeeper Identification Guide in front of you. Those are yours to keep. They're laminated, so you can put them in your boat, your kayak. If you need additional copies, we do have additional copies back at the office. We weren't 100% certain how many were coming, so I hope there are enough for everybody here. We do have a few more in the front here, so for those in the back that need more copies, we will certainly be able to get you some. Inside the Riverkeeper Guide, I did include three little sheets of paper. The evaluation, which is very helpful for myself, and also for our grantors who provide us funds for this presentation. There's a little bit of information just that we can capture about yourselves, where you live. This is great for us to know in case you do call and make a report, or you observe something, we'll be able to look back into our Riverkeeper volunteer database so we can identify where you might be located on the river. And then the last little piece is a little shameless promotion about Save the River itself, our trifold. We are a membership-based organization, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but I just figured it would be helpful for you to learn a little bit more about us and about all the great work that we do through this little information. The last piece that we did not bring, and I'm actually rather grateful that we did not bring them, are Riverkeeper volunteer t-shirts. If we had had 45 t-shirts in the back of the car, we probably would have never made it across the border because we are not allowed to leave anything on Canada. So typically we give anybody that attends a training a Riverkeeper t-shirt, and it does look like what Lee's sweatshirt looks like. I'll make Lee stand up, Vanna. And on the back would say volunteer. So I would like to invite everybody, the next time you're in Clayton, New York, to please stop off at the office, and we would be more than happy to give you a t-shirt. It just means a little road trip to the Thousand Islands, so please join us. And I think the only other thing that I do want to mention is I did set aside on the table some just blank copy paper if you would like to take notes. Our guides are laminated, so in the event that you would prefer, if you would prefer to take notes right in, I do have a small handful of Sharpies, some permanent markers. They are up front, so if you would like to write right inside, if you just want to raise your hand and we'll just pass some markers back. But there should be paper in there as well if you want to just take notes. You're welcome to keep the Riverkeeper guidebook as well as the Save the River pencil. And Karen also made certain that everybody has the very nice float rings for your keys on your boat, or for attach it to your sunglasses, or wherever you want to put them. So, all right, great. Well, I think if that's all, we'll just go ahead and jump right into the training. So what I always try to do is I always try to take a step back and sort of put into perspective a little bit about the location of our river based on its watershed. So as we call it, the Great Lakes Basin, and what I like to do when I work with the kids is if we all hold our hands like this, anywhere the water would fall along inside our hands, it will fall to the lowest point. And the lowest point really makes up the five Great Lakes and the outflow into our river here. So we did a little research to talk a little bit about some of the facts that fall within our Great Lakes. And the image right here, anywhere where there's color, means that is the basin. Anytime any water that is within this area will eventually flow into the lakes and eventually out past our front door here. So our Great Lakes Basin contains 20% of the world's fresh water. That actually is 84% of North America's fresh water. So any fresh water found in our three countries, Mexico, US, and Canada, 84% is found right here in our five Great Lakes and on our river. If we were to take all the water out of the basin, it would be about 9 feet. We would cover the continental US under 9 feet of water. And I'm guessing it would probably extend maybe up to the top of where it says Great Lakes Basin right there. So it's a lot of water in that in our system right here. And I love this. And the kids, when we do this presentation with the kids, we say if a drop of water were to fall at the farthest west end, it would take 320 years for that drop to make its way through the system out into the Atlantic. And we always say that's probably about when the Mayflower landed into Massachusetts. But moving closer into our area here, you'll notice that in this little area here, this is Lake Ontario in its basin. But check out how far back the watershed for our St. Lawrence River extends, far back up into Canada, into Quebec. It drains nearly 483,000 kilometers of also 300,000 square miles, a small portion in New York, and a good portion in the Canadian provinces. And obviously, this water we use for our drinking, for our basically for our life lifespan, so our livelihood. And obviously, it supports a tremendous amount of plants, fish, and animal species. So we are really lucky to have this river right here. But we also hold a true responsibility for maintaining the health of our river. And that sort of is where Save the River started with. This is our small office located in Clayton. We are just right on the main Riverside Drive, and we have a staff of five. We have three full-time staff and two summer interns. So really, it's with the support of our riverkeeper community that we can actually act upon and do a tremendous amount of work, which is really fabulous. Save the River was like what Karen said it almost four decades ago, 1978. And our mission is to protect the ecology of the Upper St. Lawrence River through education, advocacy, and research. And when we mean upper, mean anywhere above the dam. So that's sort of how we delineate. Obviously, in this area, the dam is very noticeable. You know above and below. In the Thousand Islands area, it kind of gets lost in the translation. So we sort of maintain that above the dam. Save the River really does a lot with a small staff. We have quite a few advocacy programs and advocacy issues that we're working on right now. And again, I guess if I move into issues, I'll have Lee sort of touch upon them as well. But obviously, you're probably aware of the Modern Water Levels Plan that we're working to adopt, Plan 2014. We are actually working to prevent the transport of crude oil along the Great Lakes. We're doing a tremendous amount. We've actually accomplished the microbead legislation, which is great, but there still is more to do with that. And then also invasive species introductions through the ballast, but then also more about, and we'll talk a little bit more about the invasive species that are found in and around our area and how what we can do to help prevent the spread of that. Our education and advocacy programs, we do a lot within our community in the Thousand Islands, but also stretching along both sides. And we're really excited about how much momentum is gaining with the support of our riverkeepers and just our volunteers in general. We have a thriving education program. Our education program extends from grades K through 12. We do a lot within the schools on the US side, and we're hoping we have interest on the Canadian side. Our riverkeeper program, last year we trained our 1,000th riverkeeper over the last 7 years. So we have a very strong cadre of volunteers who are aware of issues that are out there, and they're reporting them back to us. Our catch and release program has expanded from our beloved muskellunge into the bass and the pike right now. We're really excited about that. And then our monitoring programs. We work with groups of volunteers up and down the river to monitor the common tern. Obviously, you might know a lot about them down here. We have volunteers actively counting nests and banding chicks. It's a really wonderful program. And then water quality monitoring is a big one that we're working on. A lot of the beaches along, found along the river that aren't tested for safe levels by the state, we'll actually go out and test ourselves and report back. So all this just provides an enjoyable opportunity for us to learn about the river, and then also for our community to be involved, to have ownership over the river's health and safety, which is we're very pleased about. The one thing that I just wanted to mention is, in the news about a week and a half ago, word came out that the American Rivers has been, the St. Lawrence River has been nominated one of its most endangered rivers this year. And I don't know if Lee, you want to take a quick minute to sort of update or provide an update on that, or do any quick little piece on that?
Actually, I'll take the consensus of the group. I'm wondering, maybe we continue with the training.
Sure.
And we can come back to this. This is a really important thing to be, you know, to have a river that's as beautiful as ours and outwardly as healthy when you look at the surface, to be named one of the 10 most endangered in America is sobering. And obviously, I'll let the secret out. We nominated the river because we felt like it was important enough that it needs a new water levels plan that's languishing, unfortunately, in both our federal governments. So it's worthy of discussion, but you guys signed up for the Riverkeeper training. Let's do that, and then I think I'm more than happy, probably to bore you to death with what this means, what we need you to do, and how we can make this thing happen so that we actually are working with American Rivers to put a big X over that and be able to shout out that we've taken care of the problem. And we think we're this close in getting groups like this to help us get that message out as part of it.
Okay, great. And then we do have additional information set in the back for that. Karen mentioned that we are part of a larger a global network, the Waterkeeper Alliance. Our designation was awarded to us in 2004, the Upper St. Lawrence River Keeper. And collectively, there are over 280 waterkeeper organizations throughout the world that are fighting for the right for clean, fresh water. And even in our local area right here, there's the Ottawa Riverkeeper, the Lake Ontario Riverkeeper, us, the Upper St. Lawrence Riverkeeper, and then it just spreads out from there. So having a network like that provides a strong voice for freshwater globally, and we have organizations from all over that are fighting for freshwater within their area, as well as working to advocate on our behalf too. And it's a wonderful, it's a wonderful designation to have, so we're really pleased about that. The sturgeon itself, this logo right here is the logo, and that's found on all of the Waterkeeper Alliance logo information, so we keep that everywhere. So, back to why we're all here, riverkeepers. Basically, as part of the designation for the Upper St. Lawrence River Keeper, the idea is to put eyes and ears out on the river to report back to us what's going on. You know, again, like I mentioned earlier, we're a small staff. We're in tiny little Clayton, New York, and our river is a very expansive river. As being able to best advocate for the health of the river, we need volunteers who are interested in learning about the issues and can have a voice and act as the voice for our river to report back to ourselves, to the St. Lawrence River Institute, so that we can then disseminate that information out to the governing bodies. We do that by basically learning about issues that are hot and topics found on the river today, and then being able to report back to us. So here's Lee again, and I always mention that Lee actually, the organization has the designation of the Upper St. Lawrence River Keeper, but there's only one keeper per organization, so Lee holds the designation. So we're really doing a lot of Lee's job by being out there as the eyes and ears, so.
And I really appreciate it.
So it's great, no, but it's always nice to have an extended cadre or a large family of Riverkeeper volunteers out there. So I would say, because this is the first training of the 2016 year, we now have 1,050 Riverkeeper volunteers. So this is really wonderful. So here's the question, how do we do that? And the neat thing about that is that we're using the river itself to tell us what's going on. How many of you have ever heard of or have ever read the story of the Lorax? What did the Lorax do, or what did it, what was its saying that he always said? Who remembers that? I am the Lorax, and I speak for the
trees.
Trees, right, yeah. So in many ways, the trees can't speak, right? So we, as river keepers, do the same with our river. The Lorax does not have a voice, and we are that voice for our river. But there's a way for us to do that that's really exciting, and basically we're using biological indicators that are telling us about the health of the river. So basically, we can speak on behalf of the river because we know our river well. For those that live in certain bays or along certain stretches, and you are out there fishing or kayaking or boating in an area, and you see something every day out there, and then all of a sudden you don't see it, your river is talking to you. Your river is saying, there's something going on right now that we need to take a, look, a closer look at. So basically, biological indicators are able to help. They, by learning about the issues, they will be able to tell us what's going on in the river. Basically, then you collect the information, you know, report, jot it down in either a notebook or throw it in your smartphone and take a picture, report that back to us, and then we can take that information, share it with the St. Lawrence River Institute, Environment Canada, the DEC, other agencies, and then make action happen, which is really great. We can speak for the river. Here's just two simple indicators that are out there that we often see, or in many cases we don't see. Salamanders, amphibians, and turtles have very porous skin. So if you typically do see them and all of a sudden you don't, there may be a pollutant that's in the water. Very, very simply, we'll go into more detail, but that's an indicator that you may not, there might be an issue happening in that area. One of the things that the guidebook explains is we've kind of broken it down and we follow along with this presentation. There's three sections. We talk a little bit about the native species, the emerging invasive species, and then also the pollutants. You're going to find inside your book little what we call riverkeeper tips. There's a little green heron. A lot of good safety tips are going to be shared in there. I highly encourage you after the training to take this, take a few minutes, just run through it, enjoy reading it. Again, if you want more copies, we can certainly get more copies to you and your family members. But a lot of this is just good information to keep on hand, and I will have to say that always new information is happening and emerging. So as you are able to learn about these issues, there's probably more issues now that we don't even have in our books that, you know, are just continually learning. So I really, for you to be able to join us for today is great. And I'm sure as you attend other seminars through the St. Lawrence River Institute, you're going to learn even more about the other indicators that are out there. So that being said, the last little section is how to report. And we'll end our training right now with a little bit on the issues and the topics that you want to make certain you note and report back to us. Also in the book, there's some good information and some good contact information in there. I do want to point out that both the Canadian Coast Guard and the U.S. Coast Guard, easily you would want to report any kind of spill immediately off to them. And especially both Environment Canada and New York Spill Hotline. Actually, we had some 1-800 numbers put in here, and then it was brought to my attention that if you have a 1-800 number on the Canadian side, but your cell phone is pinging off of the U.S. side, it won't actually work. So we took them out. And I would almost encourage, if you want, maybe in your cell phones, create a new contact that just says Riverkeeper. Perhaps you may want to throw in there the Environment Canada Spills Hotline, the U.S. side, and the different Coast Guard numbers. It's just one thing for you to think about. So if, in case you don't have the book handy, but you always carry your phone with you, just something to think about. Maybe you want to throw Save the Rivers phone number in there as well, our website, all the contact information that you think you might need as moving forward. What I have in my phone, I just call it Riverkeeper, and then it's right there. So it's just one suggestion. And again, great helpful hints and great supply suggestions are found in the book. So I'm going to just jump right into the wildlife sections, and we're going to begin with the indigenous species, the native species found here. And we'll start with, I'm sure there are many anglers in the audience. How many here love to fish? It's a pretty extensive list, and we'll just run right through them. But basically, what I'm going to talk about is the species that we have up here. We'll just touch upon some of the issues that they are facing, and ID how you can identify and what to report back. So, who can tell me what this is?
Muskies,
right? So, muskies is a top predator feeder. Basically, they are the fish of the area. We always encourage folks, if you do catch them, obviously to release them. Right. Some muskies may have tags, so obviously if you do catch a muskie that has a tag, you may want to just jot that down, make the call back to us, letting us know the tag number, and we can get that information out.
I also want to point out, this is, we've been doing this now for 28 years. I believe.
Yeah.
Encouraging catch and release. If you catch and release a legal limit size muskie, and report the information to us, and we have a form to do that. And it's with an affidavit, so somebody has to be there with you. You can't just do the fish town. We will give you a Michael Ringer print of a muskie. Those of you who don't know Michael Ringer, he's an artist based in the Clayton area who does just tremendously beautiful river prints of different things, mm-hmm. except for the ships. But his fish prints are beautiful, and that's one of our inducements to anglers who actually catch and release. And we've got files and files of people who've been doing this over the years. And what we do with the information you provide us in terms of size and weight is give it to the Thousand Islands Biologic Station, which is part of the State University of New York. And they use it as part of their continuing studies into the health of this fish.
Very important. And I thank you so much for bringing that up. Another wonderful large fish that often are found here. Who can tell me what this is?
Northern pike.
Again, a lot of research is being conducted on the northern pike. So if you happen to catch, the tags for the northern pike are typically in their jawbone. You may want to just take a quick peek to see if you might see one. You might be able to, if you do happen to identify, let us know what color the tag is. There might be some more information found on there. Northern pike we're not seeing a lot anymore because of the loss in habitat found in the wetlands where they spawn. Unfortunately, with our current water levels plan, it's not helping out the wetlands in our area, and we're hoping once the plan is adopted that we'll see some reversal and bring back some of the diversity found in our wetlands. But there is a real concern for the pike species, along with a lot of our native fishes here in the area. Now, how about this one? Smallmouth?
Largemouth.
I love it. I'll just go back to the smallmouth. One way that a fourth grader taught me how to identify that is that, who can tell me, you know how to...
The corner of the mouth is in front of the eye.
Right, exactly. The corner of the mouth is in front of the eye, so it's small, and then the large mouth is behind the eye. And I tell you, once I learned that, I was able to identify them every time I caught one, which has only been maybe twice, but I was really proud of myself. So, again, we're seeing a lot of large bass, but we're not seeing a lot of the young bass coming up into the area. And unfortunately, what's happening is that gobies are taking over and eating the fry and the young fish found on the nest right now. And unfortunately, it's our fishery is out of balance, and we're really trying to learn a little bit more about what's happening with that. But it is a concern. So please, by all means, if you do catch, you know, eat. If you do eat that day, eat it fresh, but please try to release the rest. It is kind of helpful to have fish back in the area. So this is a really special one. I mean, they are found down in this area, right? Who can tell me what this is?
Sturgeon,
right. And actually, a tremendous amount of research is being conducted with your group, as well as the DEC and the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York. A lot of the spawning beds are now being restocked, and we're hoping to see more come along. But it's a very special fish. And one of the things that we're trying to encourage is to let people know about the fish so that if they do catch it, it is absolutely illegal to catch. So you want to immediately release it right back into the waterways. This is one thing you don't even want to consider catching and keeping. Here's another one that we don't see a lot, unfortunately. Who can tell? All together, what is this?
American eel.
Again, I mean, I'm sure if, who is the, is Matt?
Matt
was here.
Yes.
He's probably already talked to the group here about the American eel, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You guys could teach me more about the American eel. But again, please, if you do happen to see these beautiful species out on the river, it's just great to report back. We can get that information to Matt and all the other good researchers out there. One of the things that we always talk a little bit about is the importance of understanding what the species is and kind of knowing why you want to report back. A lot of great information is found in the book here. And then as we move away from the fish in the area, I just want to say that just the notion of catch and release is so special. You know, we want to make certain that the fisheries in our area are here for future generations. And again, I know many anglers love to eat the fish in the area, but I do also want to note that you may want to check just the regulations on how many you can legally catch and for your own health and safety on what you're eating in the area as well. It's just something to note. We're kind of moving up into the sky now, so this is one that I mentioned earlier. Who can tell me what this one is? Common tern, right. So they often, you know, the common tern really rely on rocky shoals and slow rocky areas right inside the river to nest. Right now we're actually seeing them nest along navigation cells and other areas. If you do happen to see, and again, if you are familiar with an area and you don't really see a lot of common tern, then all of a sudden you do see them, that's really great. I mean, that information can get shared back to the research happening in the area. We often don't see this. This is probably one of the coolest birds out there. And unfortunately, we don't see this because of the loss of wetland habitat, unfortunately, but we are always keeping an eye out for them. This is the black tern. And how often has anybody ever seen one here? No, I know, but they should be here. And we're hoping that as maybe with the more, again, with the water levels plan coming back into play, we'll see a reversal in some of the degradation in our wetlands. We'll see the return of the black tern. The loons, I know, are the northern voice of the river here, the common loon. You know, this poor species has really had a rough go, but we're seeing an increase in pairs and nesting populations coming back. But they are still prone to disease as well. So if you do know of a pair that you see year after year after year and all of a sudden you don't see it, it's something for us to note. Or on the other side, if you happen to see a pair that has never been in the area, then all of a sudden you do see a pair. That's really special for us to know, and then we can pass that along. There is a loon census that happens every July, third week in July on the river, and it's a wonderful way to be involved with a larger network of advocates. So if you're interested in that, I know that Adirondack Council sort of oversees the river area, and then certain regions are managed by certain land trusts. I know in the Thousand Islands area, it's the Thousand Islands Land Trust. Maybe down here there might be another group that might manage it. But it's a wonderful way to just get out there and use your eyes and use your ears for good on a special day. The bald eagle. We are seeing a wonderful return of these. It's always good to note if you do know where the nests are to let us know, but we really do try to not disclose that location out too broadly because there is still some concern in terms of, you know, making certain that the nests are safe and maintained. I know in our area we've recently, there's about 6 or 7 nests in the Thousand Islands now. And it's slowly increasing from 0, which was about 8 or 9 years ago, I believe. So we are seeing a new return of the eagle in our area, and we're really pleased to see that. So who can tell me what this beauty is? The blandings, right. Right. So the next few slides, we're just going to touch upon some of our special turtles. The blandings turtle often will find its way back into marshy lands along the sides, so you may see them crossing roads. That's a big thing right now that we're always making certain that people are aware. If you happen to find a turtle on the side of the road and you do choose to stop to move it, which direction do you want to move the turtle? Right. You want to make sure you move the turtle in the direction that it's going towards. You never want to put a turtle back on the other side, even if it's closer, because what's going to end up happening? It's going to try to cross the road again. So yeah, that's just something that it's always helpful to understand and to know. But this species is, at least on the New York side, it is a threatened species. New York, I think is it here too? Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah, and that's the other thing I'll note. In our books, we did list the species of concern status inside our books, so for both for New York State and for Ontario. Now this one here, the spiny softshell turtle, probably we don't see in this area. It's typically found out in Lake Ontario. They do bury down in the sand, but you'll see them back in some of the sandy bays along Ontario. Wolf Island, I believe, has a couple little populations over there. But if you ever want to see one up close, the New York State Zoo in Watertown, New York, has a wonderful display of two of these, and they're most amazing creatures ever to sit there and watch. They're just fabulous, and I highly encourage, when you come to Clayton to get your t-shirt, take a trip down to the zoo so you can meet the spiny softshell turtle. So all of these that we're kind of pointing out right now all end back up to the die-offs. And die-offs can happen as a result of temperature change in the water, but it can also indicate another concern, most likely pollutants in the area. And one of the things that we're always looking for is reports back for die-offs. And typically a die-off is designated as five species found within several yards of one another. By all means, if you happen to come across a die-off, whether it's fish, waterfowl, birds, anything, by all means, please let somebody know about that, because there is a bigger concern that could happen. And it's just this, again, it's an indicator. It's telling us, the river is telling us what's going on. This next slide actually is a slide of muskies that unfortunately were found not within yards, but up and down the river in 2005. And as a result of people calling and reporting and notifying agencies that they're finding all these dead muskies, they were able to determine about the virus, the viral hemorrhagic septicemia virus. So right now the virus is, they think it still is in the system right now, but it has sort of waned a little bit. But as a result, we did lose a tremendous number of muskies found throughout our system. So die-off information is really, it's sad and it's heartbreaking when you see it, but please let anybody know if you do happen to find a die-off found in your area.
We have a young girl who was doing research on the turtles in our territory.
Okay.
That was us named. And what she did is she researched and she went to go find the traditional culture names through our Mohawk language. And there was one turtle she could not find the original name for it. And she ended up turning that whole research thing into a play.
Oh, you're kidding.
It has to do with the turtle finding his name. And she created all the turtle shells from scratch and everything like that. And she went to the schools and everything like that. She does it in our traditional language, and she also does it in English as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I think they recorded it. Put it on video.
I think it would be wonderful to share that. Maybe.
Yeah,
that
was she made from all the turtle shells by hand with the
paper mache. Yeah. They're amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have our contact information. Please let us know next time it's going to be somewhere. Or
yeah.
It would be great to see.
Does she do the play on occasion, or is it by invitation?
She's coming back to our, because her contract just ended, she had a 3-year contract. Her contract just ended, but she's coming back in a different position. Mm. But we could see if she would want to do something like that.
Wonderful.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting goosebumps. That's great.
Because she's researching all the turtles in our territory and identifying, she was mapping them all.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Like that.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah, and then there was one turtle she just couldn't find the name to. And then she ended up turning all that research.
What's the name of the play?
Whatever turtle lives finds his name. Mm.
That's great.
Yeah, Anoa finds his name, which means turtle in Mohawk, but by the end of the play, he has a totally different name.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Wow,
he goes to all the different turtle families and tries to find his name.
Oh, I love it. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
I will definitely.
Yeah,
I can
let's
put
do
you in
that.
Touch with Cindy.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. Oh, great. So I'm learning so much. This is wonderful. One of the things that I want to point out again in our guidebooks has a lot of good safety pieces that I want to just touch upon. This little, the little green heron in the circle, these riverkeeper tips, again, I'll just make, just emphasize, take a quick peek at those. Just make sure that you can just read through them just so that you know. So little things, you know, for example, you know, making certain that you're not touching anything dead with your bare hands, you know, well, if you're able to sort of collect maybe some gloves and keep them in your kayak or in your dry bag or perhaps in your boat, just something to keep in mind. A lot of good information, and we'll touch upon those again later on at the end of the talk. Invasive species that are not from this area that are introduced most likely through human interaction, whether it's from ballast water in our large lakers and freighters, or whether it's collected off the back of our own boats and trailers, and just even by our own pant legs, walking through creeks and streams and whatnot. Invasive species are on the move, and unfortunately, they are changing the ecosystem found in our area. Our approach is basically, we have unfortunately, the zebra mussels and the gobies are in the area. But it's the emerging ones, it's the ones that are not found in the area yet, but that are on the move, are what we're sort of focused on in the area. And again, there's way more out there that we can certainly talk about in our short amount of time today. So the ones that I'm just going to broadcast or share right now are just some of the ones that are sort of eminent or at our back door right now. But there are a lot more out there, and I really encourage you to get out there and learn about them as much as possible. Basically, in our Great Lakes systems, there's 186 species, and I'm sure the number has increased even now, because every 28 weeks, approximately, a new resident is established. So again, this number is continually to increase and is on the rise. Movement can happen easily from lakes to the river, from river to river, from creek to river, from river to creek, you know, from ponds. There's a lot of movement out there, and we're just hoping that if we're aware of some of the issues right now, we can sort of report them and then also know what to do if you do find them. Sure.
And you really don't want to be in the position I was. Went to a great bi-national meeting put on by our congresswoman, and basically the St. Lawrence River was identified as the vector. We were like ground zero. The Adirondacks didn't want us. They wanted to draw a red line around the river. So because we've been so open to the international shipping industry and have been really the place where they've been introduced, frequently the St. Lawrence River is the source in the potential problem. So it's really important to pay attention to what's going on with invasives. And if you boat and you go from here to some other place, just clean it before you go. And if you do go some other place, why would you? Because it's the most beautiful place to boat there is. If you do go to some other place, wash before you come back.
Very true. So obviously the goby is here. You know, when the goby was introduced, came in through ballast water, was first identified in Lake St. Clair about 11 years ago. I think 2004, 2005 is when we started really seeing them. You know, if somebody had been able to say, hey, this isn't really from here, what are we supposed to do about this? How do we take action? Obviously, nothing really was brought to anybody's really attention after it was too late. And as a result, the gobies have sort of, like I said earlier, altered the ecosystem, have just decimated the food pot, the food source for many of our native fish. And it'll be interesting to see what else happens as a result of the gobies being here. The next few that I'm just going to touch upon are, again, like I mentioned, at our back door. So this is the bloody red shrimp. It is found in the Montreal area, and I do not think it has been up into this area yet. But you can see them. You can see them with the human eye, but in the nighttime, if you have a flashlight and you look around your docks and whatnot, you may see little swarms of them. They also are voracious eaters, and they will eat the zooplankton and other food source for our native fish in the area. These are not the, also, these are, I just want to point out that often we see the little crustacean, you know, the little claws, do you see them on like the shoreline after the gulls pick them apart? Those are not the same as these. So those are a different, they're different. But this is the bloody red shrimp. This is the ruff that is found in Lake Ontario. They too sort of come in and eat out, you know, they just will go in and just eat all of the food source for our native fish. They do sort of wreak havoc back in the bays and areas, but they also dive very low, and they kind of are all over the place, actually. So if you do catch one, you'll just need to know what, actually, if you do catch one, it is an invasive species. It's in the state of New York. If you knowingly know that it's an invasive species, you're really not supposed to put it back in the system. So if you do catch one, it's important to let us know so we know. We can then report back to those who are on the lookout for them. This is an interesting one. The Chinese mitten crab is also downriver. Montreal Harbor, I believe, has these as well. These two, similar to the bloody red shrimp, will sort of decimate the food source for our native fish. And they, I should mention that all of these were introduced through ballast water as they came in. So as they were coming in, you know, does everybody know? I should actually have mentioned, is anybody familiar with what ballast water is and does? On ships, okay. Does anybody need a quick refresher? One of the easiest way that I can explain ballast water, and again, I love it when I get to explain it to the kids that we teach. Ballast water is the water that's contained in the bottom of the ship that rights the ship. So how many of you have been in a pool and have jumped on a beach ball? Nobody?
Nobody.
Ah, you missed out. So if you're in your pool and you jump on a beach ball, what are you going to do? You're going to flip right over, right? So if you add a little water inside that beach ball, then you jump on it, you'll actually hang on a little bit longer because that water displaces the air inside there and actually rights the beach ball. It's the same technique as what ships use in order to cross the ocean. So what they do is they intake water from the port. It helps the boat right its way, go along the ocean, and before it leaves and when it has to displace itself with its cargo, it has to release the water. But when it releases the water, what do you think it releases with it?
Everything
in it. So that's kind of my quick and dirty explanation of ballast water. So there you go. Try it next time you have a beach ball and you're in your swimming pool or out in the river. This one is actually at the other end of our system right now. Who can tell me what this might be?
Carp,
right, Asian carp. Asian carp, here's a perfect example of an invasive species that has taken over an area. So right here, 1975, they were used to clean out ponds in the Arkansas area after a big flood. The floodwaters took out over the ponds and the Asian carp spilled out. And as a result, now 40 years later, you can see that they have just come up into the entire Mississippi system. Now the Mississippi Basin and the Great Lakes Basin really does not connect naturally. They are within maybe 10 miles apart, or the watered ways within itself that don't touch, with the exception of the canal system in Chicago, where they reverse the flow, and as a result, there's great concern of Asian carp entering into the Great Lakes Basin. And who can tell me? Does anyone know what's keeping them back?
Electric fences.
Yeah. Right.
Not enough of them.
There's tremendous concern. There's a lot of action being taken right now to instill legislation to make that change. And I'm sure you want to have a few things to say, too.
I would just say, once you guys sign the piece of paper we have for the water levels, it's interesting to us because Canada is so involved in so many issues. And you know, both countries have taken turns being leaders and not so great leaders on Great Lakes issues. And this Asian carp invasion, once they make it to Lake Michigan, they're not going to care which country they came from, and they will be all over. And we are fighting a tremendous fight. It's one of the reasons why it's great to be a water keeper, and part of the freshwater network. There's legislation in our Congress. We're doing everything we can to try to come up with actual physical separation. Because what Kate didn't say is that the reason the water from Chicago goes to the Mississippi River now instead of Lake Michigan is that 100 years ago they realized that they were flushing their toilets into their drinking water. So they decided to flush their toilets and let it go to Mississippi instead. And that's why the Asian carp are knocking at our door. We don't see any real direct concerted action right now on the Canadian side, but I think it's a Great Lakes issue that gives, because it's a Great Lakes issue, it gives anybody in Canada who's concerned about the integrity of the lakes an opportunity to speak to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I would say directly to our State Department to say this has got to stop. It's a tremendously expensive proposition to separate. And the electric fence, which is a very clever idea, it's also subject to, you know, it's almost to the point where somebody trips over the plug and they go down and the fish can come over. Mm-hmm. So it's this, you know, there's no good invasive species. Invasive species are, you know, the ones that crowd everything else out of the niche. This is the only one, and you can see them jumping, they will be able to crowd us out of the niche, because you cannot take a fast boat, a pleasure craft, or a kayak down a river where these guys are infesting.
Very true. Thank you. So I'm just going to quickly touch upon a few of the aquatic plants that are also sort of on the move and moving into our area. Water chestnut is a very fast moving by small boat in particular. Small boat, our own pontoon boats, little boats, things that get wrapped around the propellers and moving on. This right here can get wrapped up and then spread along with the barbs right here, these little seeds, this right here. Unfortunately, it is found in like Lake Champlain has a lot. Hudson River has a fair bit, unfortunately. In the Lake Ontario area, it is found within some of the bays leading up to the river. And actually, we just had a recording on the backside of Wolf Island now. So this is on its way. And this next slide that I'm going to show you is a stark contrast to what you would normally expect to see in what you would expect to see as water.
Oh my gosh.
So these are biological technicians about to start a day of hand pulling water chestnut in a small bay. So I would imagine by the end of the day, they would not be as energetically waving their hands and saying, yay. I imagine they are going to be very tired. Unfortunately, this does take hold, and it is hard to get rid of once it's established. So I just say water chestnut is one of the biggies that if you do happen to see it, it is extremely important to first learn what you can do to hand remove it yourself, or let us know, and then we can report it out to the other agencies. This also, which is called yellow floating heart. Oh, excuse me. Sorry.
Water chestnut. How is that dangerous to the environment?
Oh, that's very true. So basically, water chestnut will take over an area, and it will actually out-compete the native species that are found along the area. A lot of times, too, for example, right here, it eliminates the light from coming in, so it kind of changes the oxygen levels in the area. A lot of the fish and the species that are found in these low, shallow areas will end up moving out. And in many sense, like all the other aquatic invasive plants, deadens an area. A lot of the species don't actually live in an area found where they see this. So that's a great question. Yellow floating heart acts similar to water chestnut, and many times people will confuse this with the water lily, which is a native. But one thing to note is that the yellow floating heart, the flowers will look like this, whereas the lilies have more like the pink flower and like kind of the rosy colors. This one as well is on the move tremendously, and unfortunately is in our river and in our bays. It's Eurasian water milfoil. So this one, and also, like I mentioned earlier, it gets wrapped around propellers, and then as you move along and slow down, it will break down and fall and will propagate right then and there. So unfortunately, once this takes hold, it is very hard to remove. There's certain bays right now where families can't even get to their own docks as a result of it. Similar to how Lee indicated that the Asian carp is going to crowd us out at some point if it's not stopped. We're seeing this happening in some of the bays where families, members, and others can't actually get into the area. That's not even mentioning all the native species that are impacted, like you mentioned earlier. No native species is found in an area where this is found right now. So this next slide, there, we do have a native milfoil found in the area. So this is one thing that you may want to just take note of. Typically, the native species, you'll see one or two in an area, again, that shares its area with other native species. If you see the Eurasian milfoil, that's all you'll see in an area. I don't know if you want to just take a quick note to note this. I also have a couple other sheets I could just sort of lay out at the end if you wanted to jot down more information about this one. One of the things that we mention in here is in terms of sampling invasive aquatic plants, a lot of times you may not necessarily, if you're not 100% certain knowing what it is, if you break that off, there's a concern that it might break off and then repropagate elsewhere. Perhaps this might be a time where you just capture a photo of it and send it on to us, noting where you found it, and then we could do our best to try to identify it. We're going to just jump into the last little section, pollution. This is always on everybody's mind here, and I think this is one of the in many ways, just something that's like a lot. In many ways, it's not intended, but it does happen. So we're just going to run through some of the pollutants that are found in our area and just talk a little bit about what we can do to sort of report and then move on and then be able to help protect it. In many ways, we've been able to categorize them in four simple categories that is helpful for us to like identify. So those include toxic, sediment, nutrient, and rubbish. And those are the four sections that we're going to touch upon right now. Toxic, obviously, is by nature, it's toxic by nature, it's poisonous. It's something that's into the system that was not intended to be there, but it is there by accident. Many times it can include sheens. Have you ever heard of the term rainbow water? A lot of times you see the sheen on the water. It can be foam. A lot of times foam may indicate that there's a pollutant or a detergent in the river, in the area. And then at any times, acrid water, smelly water may also indicate something. So moving forward, we're just going to touch a little bit on the sheens right now. Unfortunately, oil and or gas is never good to happen on the river, whether it's from a small spill in a little marina or unfortunately from a big spill like the ones in this area. Obviously, we're not immune to them living on a river. We share our river with our freighters and our lakers. One of the things we want to note is that if you happen to see a sheen and or a spill, it's always helpful to try to determine the volume. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough thing because it's ever moving, you never quite know, and it's always hard to kind of quantify that. But another way, for one thing you can say is, well, it's maybe about the size of a school bus, or it's maybe about the size of a wheelbarrow. You know, if you can put that into a visual that might be able to help determine the volume, that's always important. So if you don't have your tape measure out there ruling it, you can use something else as an example. The other thing is, if there's an opportunity to identify its source, a lot of times that may not happen, but if you can identify the source, that's actually really important for those that are taking the information down, and then we can determine how to or what to do to sort of contain it. Here's that 1-800 number that I should have taken out. So I'm just going to note again, if you do put in your phone a riverkeeper contact, make certain that you put the area code properly so that you can access them in case you do ping off the different cell phone towers. This image right here, I just want to point out, this is actually from the spill that happened in 1976. right off of Wellesley Island, and still to this day, it is still the largest inland waterway spill in North America. And unfortunately, you still see evidence of the spill found along the rocks in many of the islands along that area. So we certainly don't want that to happen again. But obviously, if there is a disaster that happens, the more people that are aware of it, the better we can be informed, the better action, the quicker the action can happen. Do you want to mention anything else about soil at this point?
Well, don't call us first.
That's true.
If there's one thing you're going to report to the proper authorities first, it's a spill. Because they have the resources, we hope. There's a discussion about that, but we want to get absorbents, and we want to get the authorities on the scene who can control it. And then we'll be scolds afterwards and shake our fists and deal with it.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, don't call us, call them. Foam is something that often happens naturally, but it also can happen as a result of a detergent or a pollutant in the water. A lot of times after heavy rains, the wind just churns the water around and creates foam. But also if an area, for example, if you have a leaky septic system or straight pipes, unfortunately, that are still found in old cottages, detergents found in there may end up causing foam to happen. This picture was actually submitted from a Riverkeeper volunteer the first year that we gave this training. After they took the training, they were very concerned about this. They called us up. We were able to talk through it. And basically what we determined was by having them smell the foam, if it had an earthy, fishy smell, it was determined that it was a natural foam. If it had a perfumey or a detergent smell, that would be an indicator that it was a pollutant. So the other thing that we pointed out was by looking at that photo, the water is choppy, it's kind of gray. We were able to say, well, was there rain within the last 24 hours? Well, yes, there was. Well, then it's probably just a natural occurrence. Smelly water often happens as a result of pesticide runoff. It can happen from waste treatment systems that are overchlorinating or it just enters the area. Obviously, if the water smells bad, we don't want you to stay in that area. We just ask you to sort of note it and move on. But by all means, if you can identify the smell, for example, the chlorine or whatnot, that's something that's really helpful for us to know as we make our reports. Sedimentation. This is an interesting one. I'm sure this is sort of common, unfortunately, in and along our tributaries and our creeks and our streams. Unfortunately, it can happen as a result of construction and also agricultural activity. We often find that, obviously, new construction found in along an area has to have what we call silt checks or silt dams. In the event they're installed improperly, it may cause runoff from flowing back into the streams. But more importantly, agriculture often is the case. And obviously, there are strict rules put in place where animals can't access waterways, but unfortunately it does happen in areas. So it's always important if you do happen to see something or see sediment in the water, being able to trace it back up to its source is important for us. Again, nutrient pollution too. Nutrient is a polite word for what? Yeah, poo, basically. So nutrient pollution is an issue. Again, like I mentioned earlier, it can happen from failing septic systems or straight pipes, but also agricultural practices. In Canada, do you use the term the honey wagon?
Oh, yeah.
So obviously in the early spring, if they spray the fields while there still is ice on the ground, and then unfortunately that may run off back into the streams, that's obviously something to be concerned about. And it's always good for us to kind of, again, this can be tricky and can be sensitive. Again, if you want to report something but choose to remain anonymous, you are very welcome to do so. So you don't have to be the reporter to rat out a neighbor in many ways. If you just want to let us know about it, we can certainly act as that person to sort of pass the message along. So that's one thing that's always important. That does come up in many times with ag practices. But also nutrient pollution happens as a result of the CSOs and the SSOs, combined sewer overflows. And then obviously we all sort of are aware of what happened downriver last fall, Montreal. That was probably one of the biggest ones in our current area, but it doesn't mean that it's not the only one that happens. You know, all up and down our river and into Lake Ontario, there are often flow overflows that happen. So if we know about them and we're aware, we can actually get the word out to let people know perhaps they don't want to bathe or swim or boating in the areas when those are occurring. This is an example of a straight pipe that is actually discharging waste. It was actually sent back to us from a riverkeeper who chose to remain anonymous. But one of the things that we always point out is the lovely green color that is found here. Often you'll see that along the shoreline or actually right along the rocks underneath the water. It's a good indicator. We had a couple folks who were kayaking after they took the training, and they were able to report back to us at a camp out one on a Mink Island, which is, I believe, in Goose Bay, right outside of Alex Bay. We were able to take some information back and call the town and see what we were able to sort of help that process along. So it's always good to sort of know what to keep an eye out for. The last one really is just garbage. You know, garbage that's dumped intentionally or on accident can actually harm not only our native species in the area, but you never know if there's a pollutant or a chemical that's found in it that leaks out. One of the things that I often recommend is if you're building your riverkeeper kit, so you have your phone with the riverkeeper ID, you have your gloves in your dry bag, perhaps you want to grab one of those can picker uppers, or for those that aren't as tall as I am that need to reach things off high shelves, those grabbers. We now keep those in our kayaks because it's great. You can not only fish out your hat, but you can fish out garbage and everything. So as you're building your riverkeeper container, it's also something for you to keep in mind as well, because we certainly don't want this to happen to our own native species found in our area. So we throw this in just sort of to lighten the mood at the end of the day, but we certainly do not want this to happen to our species here. So we're sort of really wrapping up, and I'm pleased that we're able to move along, because I know this is going to leave a great amount of time for discussion afterwards. But just in a quick nutshell, we ask that our riverkeeper volunteers, and again, it's really up to you to determine how much time you want to spend out there and what you want to do with it. Some people take the information and just take it and absorb it and pass it along to their friends and families. Some others really like to take it and do little patrols, as they would. You know, if you have a kayak or a paddleboard and you want to go up and down your little area a couple times and pay attention to areas, especially right now as the spring is moving into summer, you'll be able to observe all that starting to grow up into the area. It's just great. It's just good information for you to know. Being able to know your part of the river, you know your neighborhood better than anybody else. So if you see something that wasn't there or you see something that's missing, that right there, that river, like that Lorax, it's telling you something about what's happening in your neighborhood. And that's what we want to hear about. The best part is if you can take the good and the bad, record basic information about the day, the date, the time, the weather, all that information will help us build our story about what you're seeing. That's all great information. And then again, reporting it to Save the River, to the St. Lawrence Karen, the St. Lawrence River Institute, we can then pass that information back on to others. So basically, the other thing is you can do so. And my next slide is we have a couple online reporting systems. But when we do this presentation in the Thousand Islands area, we get a lot of people just walking in and telling us, which is great. But for folks down here, it's a long walk. So I encourage you to use the next little setup here. So how to report. We were able, through a grant that we received through the St. Lawrence River Research and Education Fund, we were able to build a database on our website that is easily accessed not only by a computer at home, but through your smartphone. And the website is very simple. It's report.savetheriver.org. And we did note that on the very last page in your ID guidebooks, we put a little sticker in there that has that information. It will easily prompt you down with all the questions we would answer or ask of you on the phone. So basically, location, what did it smell like, where did you see it, how much, all the information that you'll be able to tell us, even if you can't identify the species, but you think it doesn't look right, that's okay. The best part about this reporting page is if you use your smartphone, it geolocates to your location, so it can send us an exact GPS data point.
Cool.
And you can actually upload images taken right there. So for example, like I mentioned, if you saw a plant species that you weren't certain about, you can go ahead and just take a quick picture of it, hit that button, and it'll upload. All that information goes to my email, and then I can then follow up with you, get on the phone, we can have a conversation, and we'll determine the best course of action after that. The one thing that I didn't put in here, or actually, oh, there it is, Karen. I wanted to make certain that we have Karen's contact information here as well. So this is not in the book. So I do want to mention that I'm sure many of you have her email and her phone number because of the RSVP, but Karen has graciously offered to act as the reporting receiver on this end for our this community right here. So it's great. We're very happy about that. And then she and I can work together and we can kind of make action happen. Got it? Now I'm going to go back to the map. This is great. So this is a thing that we've built since we've created the reporting page, because a lot of people are asking, where are the invasive species sightings? Where are the pollutants typically being found? And when they call us, then we say, that's a great question. Let me go back in my brain and figure out where all those were. Actually, anytime that you make a report, it actually filters into our map now, and you can actually use these side parts right here. Report type. If you're curious about a die-off, you can just unhide those, and then it'll point out all the different die-offs that have been reported. So this is not everything that's happened on the river, it's just has been reported. So we're actively looking for participation for these reports to be made on our page so that they can start at, we can start filling in those missing areas. And our goal is that this information here can be shared, it's public, can be shared by researchers, by agencies that are looking for that information, and it's an easy access. So, and it's not only our side of the river, but the Canadian side, our side, all over the place. So it's very easy to use. You don't have to do anything to the map. Anything that you upload onto that reporting page automatically gets loaded up into that. So we're really excited about this. And if I had a Wi-Fi connection, I would actually pull it up. But it's found right on our website, and the easiest way for you to access it is just go to that report.savetheriver.org, and from there it'll locate you back to the map. So we're really excited about that. Again, here's Karen's contact information. Thank you very much. If anybody else needs that, I'm sure it's on all of the contact, the paper, the information found in the front as well. I just want to point out that our website, savetheriver.org, does have a lot of great background information. And again, one thing that I always say is, I can't take enough time out of your day to fill you in on all the issues that are at hand with our beautiful river, but at least this website that we have can share a lot more background information on it, and it certainly has been developed over several years, many years, with a lot of great writing and a lot of great research and thought put into it. So you'll learn a lot more about our river if you go to our website right here, savetheriver.org. Again, as you stop in Clayton to get your free t-shirt, you can collect a lot, as much information as possible. We have a lot of great fact sheets that are found right there. And then again, if anybody is interested in more Riverkeeper guides, we are very happy to mail them to you, or I can easily make certain that there's a stack and a resource found at the Institute office. We are very happy to share this information out to you, and I'm just really pleased that you're here, that you can take this information back. But again, if you would like more guides, I'm very happy to give them to you. And really, really quickly, safety is important. That's stressed throughout the guidebook. So as much as you're excited to take a look at something, but you always want to think about your safety first. So we just ask that you think about that as you're looking and investigating issues. But I also want to thank Karen and the St. Lawrence River Institute for hosting us and for just being so generous and for being available to our river. It's not just the organization, but it's to our river. So thank you. And we are very happy to talk further, even after the presentation or even over the phone, if you want to follow up with questions. We're always happy to talk, and that's what we're here for.
I just wanted to say thank you so much to Kate and Lee for coming down here. So, I mean, we're all caring about the same things, and the excitement I have is that you were able to come, so thank you so much for coming. And that if you're interested in any of this, you can contact either organization and that information will be shared. We don't believe in silos around here. The river, it flows together, and all of our little tributaries come together on this great river. So I really appreciate everyone for coming. I nyawa to all the people that came from Akwesasne tonight. I'm thrilled to have three nations here. It's really cool. I mean, how often do you get that? Three nations, one great river. And I just want to thank Kate and Lee again for everything that you've done and for all your work. You guys are awesome.
Thank
you so much for coming, everybody. Yeah. And make sure to get in touch if you have questions. Their emails are there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Again.
Great job. Thanks for listening to Bluefish Radio. I hope you found the show both entertaining and informative. Bluefish Radio is made possible with the generous assistance from the following supporters.
Yukonuba Pet Food provides your dog with high-quality nutrition for a healthy life. Scotty, the way to fish. Whether it be from a boat, kayak, or stand-up paddleboard, Scotty has the gear you need to get your lines in the water. Reno Viola Outdoor Radio, home to more than 30 of North America's top outdoor radio producers. Wild Hagen Hats, shelter, comfort, confidence. A family of Canadian hat makers designing and manufacturing hats in Canada. Accessible Media Inc., the world's largest broadcast reading service, making local, regional, and national news available to those with print restrictions. Logan Tech, distributor of the portable 6-dot Braille label maker. Outdoor Canada, the definitive Canadian source for all things fishing, hunting, and conservation. And Bluefish Canada, the future of fish and fishing in Canada.
For more information on Bluefish Radio, and for more information about myself, visit lawrencegunther.com. Thanks for listening.